Good morning, everyone. Good morning on this Independence weekend. And as we think about independence, I'd like to share Wendell Berry's The Larger Circle to invite us in. We clasp the hands of those that go before us and the hands of those who come after us. We enter the little circle of each other's arms and the larger circle of lovers whose hands are joined in a dance, and the larger circle of all creatures passing in and out of life. We move also in a dance to a music so subtle and vast that no ears hear it, except in fragments. Let us not be fragmented this morning. I welcome all of you to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan, Kansas, and invite you to create community by welcoming those people around you that you may not know. Or if you do, welcome them anyway. So welcome, everyone. Welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan. If you'd like to find out more about what it means to be a member of this community, please feel free to talk to me after the service. I invite you to take in these words that help us light our flaming chalice, a symbol of our free faith, our progressive journey. A journey makes us vulnerable, takes us from our more secure environments, and commits us to the unknown. Perhaps this is why the journey has so often been more our basic metaphor for life itself. Our life journey is a precarious pilgrimage, a passage through landscapes of promise and peril, a crossing from the darkness of the womb to the shadows of death. We travel in the hope that the light will not fail to guide us, that the star shall not be lost, that homecoming will be granted, and love will not be withheld.
Oh,
I draw your attention to the announcements in our order of service. Please take a look at those later or now. Ours is a welcoming community where we find connection, a loving community where we find meaning. Ours is a sharing community where our joys are amplified, a caring community where our sorrows are lessened. We take this moment to reflect on our joys and sorrows, to acknowledge the mutual support of our community. If you would like, please share a brief verbal expression of joy or sorrow at this time. I would like to share my joy of having very dear friends, Frank and Joy, with us today. Frank will be presenting. So thank you so much for coming.
I'm Harriet Yonke, and I'm very happy to announce that we have one of the wall hangings almost completely quilted. We need to outline some leaves. And then we are starting on the second one. And we would love to have more people involved. You don't have to have prior experience. Everyone that was doing it so far, except myself, has had no quilting experience. The quilt police have not caught us yet. We would love to have some males also do this. And if you have any questions about how skilled you have to be, just ask Lori or Ilka or Judy Cattell or Sybil or who else has done it, Jane and Shirley. We've all had some stitches in it, and we have two of them, and they're big and long, so there's room for several to work at once. Monday afternoon at 2 o'clock, Monday, Tuesday, and Thursday at 2 o'clock, in my apartment or in that little living area next to us, depending on how many there are of us. So, and if some of you younger ones would like to work in the evening just so you could say you put in a few stitches, talk to me afterwards and we'll find an evening.
Hi, my name is Linda Krieger. I have a joy that I think is probably Kathleen's joy as well. I'm now chair of the caring committee, so I wanted people to be able to put a face with my name. So if you know of anybody who needs some help from our committee, just let's get me a message. And Kathleen was chair for many years, and I think she deserves a big round of applause at least.
I'm Michael Oldfather, and it's my joy as chair of the music committee to say that after only 2 years of discussion amongst people who have a concern, pianists, minister, program committee, various and sundry others, we have adopted a policy of not applauding after the offertory. And you could do it now, but not then. You are certainly free to shake hands with, if you know the pianist well enough, to hug him or her, whatever, to express your gratitude for the contribution that they make to our service Sunday after Sunday after Sunday.
I catch five bluegills and one crappie.
All right.
That's a joy.
And I'd like to express my gratitude for the drummers this morning and the beautiful rhythm and pulse of the earth that comes from them. So may we remember those who have spoken, those they have named, and those we hold in silence in our hearts. Now's the time for the story for all ages. We're going to do it over here.
Want the mic in the holder?
Hey, Colton. What? fine. Well, welcome up, everybody. How many of you have a grandmother? How many of you are close to your grandmother? Grandmothers. You may have more than one, right? Obviously. Yeah? Well, grandmothers are very important in this story. Walt was a boy of 9 years old, and his grandmother had just died. Walt had loved his grandmother because he had lived with her for a year when his mother was very sick with an illness where the father had to take care of the mother and there wasn't enough energy to also take care of the son. So when Walt was 5, he stayed with his grandmother, Sophia, and Grandpa Walt on the farm. And Grandma Sophia loved the garden. She was taught by her grandmother, who had come from a long way off, that the garden is a very important place. How many of you garden? Yeah, it's kind of fun, isn't it? Well, anyway, in the garden, there was a huge, huge old oak tree. And when they first settled on that land, someone wanted to cut down that oak tree. And Sophia's grandfather said, you know, the oak tree was bigger than that oak tree out there, and it's still bigger than that oak tree out there by about 3 times as much. Can you imagine that? And when the oak tree has a wind go through it, Sophia said, listen. Can you hear the wind moving through the oak? And then can you hear it move down the valley into the oak grove? Can you hear it move through the grasses that are above the oak trees, the tall grass prairie? So Grandma Sophie taught little Walt how to plant potatoes and peas and corn and what else would you think? Cucumbers and hot peppers. They liked hot peppers and they planted. You like cucumbers? Yes. And they planted all that, and she taught Walt how to take care of these plants by watering them when they look like all shriveled up and getting all dried out. That's when they need some water. And you try to water close to the roots and not on top of the plant, because then mold and funguses and all kinds of things can grow on the leaves and destroy the plant. So it's important to get the water to the roots, right? And then when the bugs came, she didn't like to use those chemicals because she thought, once she had used them and her skin burned for 2 weeks after she used a pesticide, it just burned and burned. So she decided she would use her grandmother's remedies. So she learned how to take care of plants in the old way so that the food tasted safer to her. It felt safer. And she said, you know what? When my grandfather died, who loved this oak tree, and we call it grandmother oak because it's so big, and it spreads out and holds so much. And can you see all the oak trees in the distance? Those are grandmother oak's children. So there are hundreds and hundreds of oaks. And she said, when my grandfather died, I came to this tree and I cried and I cried and I cried. I missed him so much. He was so good to me. He held me when I was scared. He taught me how to ride a pony. He taught me how to milk a cow and help to coddle the eggs so that they could, to warm the eggs so they could have new chicks. He taught me everything I knew. And when he died, I didn't know what I was going to do. He was one of my best friends. And Walt said, Grandma? Grandma Sophie, you're one of my best friends. I love you. I love you a lot. And so when Grandma Sophie got sick, Walt didn't want to go see her. He didn't want to see her all shriveled up. He didn't want her to see her like she was before. It wasn't before. He was afraid. And then when she died, he felt so guilty that he didn't say goodbye to his grandmother. You know, it's very important to say goodbye. It's very important to say goodbye to people you love. And Walt felt so, so guilty. And so when they had the funeral service on that day, Walt went to Grandmother Oak and sat on the bench that his grandmother had sat shelling peas. And he listened. He listened. And he said, "Grandmother Oak, why don't you talk to me? Why don't you help me? Why don't you say something?" And a wind came over the hill and down the valley and through the tree. And Walt put his back on that huge, huge, wide trunk. And he could feel the light coming through the leaves and hitting his heart. And when the light touched his heart, he could feel his grandmother's arms around him. And he said, "Grandmother, I am so sorry that I didn't say goodbye. I'm really sorry." And then the wind came again, and it went across his face, over his shoulders, through his hair, and he began to feel refreshed. And he felt at peace. He felt his grandmother was at peace. So this is the way that trees can help us in times of great sorrow. Find a tree and love it. As the earth and the sky makes our lives possible and gives continuously to us, let us be as generous in our own way. Let us support this progressive faith now. Indigenous and ancient cultures engaged themselves in the changing seasons, made medicine with the phases of the moon, and created rituals to celebrate and mark transitions from one stage to another. They took care to maintain balance and harmony in all they did. Frank.
Well, it's wonderful to be here. I've been here one other time. It was Michael and Chuck's wedding, and I was drawn by the wonderful energy here and all the beautiful people. So I want to thank Michael for inviting me to give a talk. Okay. So you can...
Can I have everyone here?
No? Oh. Can you get the first slide up? Oh, okay. Well, my talk, I don't know if you saw it. I guess you saw the blurb in the... I'm not sure what this is called, but I'm going to talk about being indigenous. I think a better title would be Becoming Indigenous, as it's a process. And so you can go to the second slide. Thank you. Okay. I'm going to talk a little bit about me and my search for meaning, and then I'm going to go through a few slides, and then we'll go and have some follow-up discussion, and then I'll take any questions. So I was raised as a Catholic in a dysfunctional family with alcoholism dynamics. So I dealt with the guilt and shame from not only the church, but also my family, as well as original sin, and I'm still wondering what that actually means. I was a dutiful son, going to church, Sunday school, but not everything was hunky-dory at my house. Throughout my childhood, I was made to go to church while my dad many mornings slept late, nursing a hangover. I was told by a nun in second grade, and you know how sensitive children are in second grade, that my aunts and uncles were going to go to hell because they weren't Catholics. And as I became a teenager, I went to school. I mean, went to church less and less, and it just didn't resonate with me anymore. The one thing that I've held to even now is the ceremony, the pomp and circumstance, and the incense and frankincense and myrrh. I always loved that. I went to a Quaker high school, and every Wednesday throughout the school year, we had meeting, and we would sit in silence until the Spirit moved us, and then we would talk. I never talked. I wasn't brave enough and didn't understand what the Spirit moving meant, but some of the older teachers who were long-term Quakers showed what that all meant. And so that was pivotal. And as a young adult, I looked hard for an alternative to Catholicism, and I remember reading Ellen Pagel's Gnostic Gospels about some Gospels that were no longer in the Bible and how the Catholic Church changed things and stuff. And I read various Native American books searching for something different. One book that I remember was Black Elk Speaks. In that blurb, it talks about how plants have taught me, have helped me on my way. And my first connection with plants, in retrospect, was after I finished college or quit college. And I was going to go hitchhike around the U.S. And I thought, well, why not learn medicinal plants and edible plants? And so that if I'm out in the middle of nowhere, I might be able to find a plant that could help with a cut, a sore, or give me something to eat. So I started studying plants more feverishly, with more passion than I did the entire time I was at Kalamazoo College. That's where I went to college the first time around. Even met Yul Gibbons. I think some of you folks remember Yul Gibbons, and he gave a talk and a walk at K College, and I bought some of his books and tried some of his things. I was even able to make mulberry cobbler, and I went clamming on the West Coast and learned how to read the sand and find out where the clams were, and I dug them up and cook some of them up. It was a little sandy, but I actually did it, and it was a lot of fun. So I look back now at that experience at that time when I was studying plants and just was so passionate. I look at that as a time when the plants caught my eye and just redirected my path along a more green path. So it's pivotal for me, because since then, and this is close to 40 years of knowing plants and learning about plants, I look, when I drive and I walk, I'm always looking at the plants. That's how I read the landscape. That's how I understand the land around me. So they touched my heart many, many, many years ago. I also studied, practiced Zen Buddhism for many years. I remember I was living out in west central Kansas in Russell, north of Russell, on hundreds of acres of land, lived in a stone house with well water that never quit. I thought I was going to live there the rest of my life because it was sort of a mini paradise. But I read Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind by Shunrui Suzuki, and I realized I needed a teacher. And there was a Zen group in Manhattan, and there was a Zen group in Lawrence, and both had universities. I wanted to go back to school. It had been 8 years, and I chose KU because they had a botany department. If I'd have known there was a Kansas Prairie at K-State, it might have made a difference, but I didn't know anything about either universities, and I ended up in Lawrence. And I practice Zen Buddhism. So can you give me my water? Thank you. So I practiced Zen Buddhism for off and on for over 30 years, and meditated, chanted, did bows, and sometimes it was quite intensely. I did a 90-day silent meditation retreat in Rhode Island. That was in between finishing undergraduate school and going to graduate school, and that was a profound experience. But a number of times I went out at night and I prayed to the Creator, beseeching it to talk to me and ask the plants to provide me wisdom and stuff. So even though I was intently meditating and working really hard for clarity, the plants, I was wanting information from the plants and from the Creator. So that was a sort of a common theme for me through my life. The thing I liked about Zen Buddhism was the simple clarity of it. You count your breathing. You repeat your mantra while you're sitting, and your mind. You watch your mind going to Paris or going back to the argument you had with your spouse, but you're still sitting in this room with other people. And there was also there was clarity there, the promise of clarity, the promise of maybe even nirvana. But that's what appealed to me about Zen Buddhism. But something that Zen didn't promise provide me was a connection to nature. Zen Buddhism isn't interested in the magical realm, you know, speaking with plants, listening to the wind and getting meaning from that. Zen is interested in being here right now, to coin a cliche. Well, I wanted something more, and so after many years and much thought, I still practice meditation, but I'm not a member of any Zen group. And I look back, and I see that what I needed was to help heal the deep wounds I suffered during childhood. And Zen Buddhism is very hard, very formal and cold on the surface. I needed something to soften my edges and open my heart in order to begin loving myself, appreciating my family, really seeing the beauty around me and connecting with nature as I long to do. I haven't practiced Zen in a while. Still meditate, still sometimes count my breath or do a mantra. But I've moved to a more earth-centered path, and I'll talk about that in some slides. And it was triggered by teachings by Stephen Buhner. Julie McIntyre, her quote is on the front page. She's the real deal, and also Trishua. They're all part of the Foundation of Gayan Studies of New Mexico. And what appealed to me with their teachings, and I knew, you know, in my head about a lot of these teachings, and they've brought those teachings into the forefront, moving them from my head into my heart where I can experience those teachings directly. But one, the things I've listed here is interconnectedness of all things. I think we all understand that. Everything is sentient and intelligent, even rocks and this paperclip. Coming to my senses through heart field work, that's critical. Connecting and communicating with nature. Reclamation of the soul. And use of ceremony in Native American trappings. In Catholic Church, there was a lot of ceremony. There was Latin being spoken back in the day. I can still remember some of the phrases that we repeat, we respond to the priest. Certainly Zen Buddhism is steeped in ceremony, and so is Native American teachings. So can we go to the next slot? Can we go to the next slide? Okay, I want to talk a little bit about my worldview. To me, the earth is alive. It's Gaia. It's breathing, a living, and dynamic organism, and we are inseparable from it. You can call it Gaia, you can call it the cosmos, you can call it the universe. And it's nature suffused with intelligence, beauty, intrinsic value, and profound meaning. And a lot of people think that's just crazy, but that was the common worldview before the 16th and 17th century when the scientific revolution became reality. You can go to the next slide. And so the scientific revolution blossomed in the 16th and 17th century after the 100-year war in Europe, a lot of famine, a lot of drought, a lot of loss of lives. And so these great philosophers, you can see them up there, Galileo, John Locke, Descartes, Isaac Newton, and others, came up with a mechanistic worldview with a scientific reductionism as its approach. And so that has just taken over our lives, and that's how most of us look at the world. And you can see what that has brought us. It's brought us an ecological catastrophe. So I want to read. We can go to the next slide. And so it's a universe as machine, no feeling, no meaning, no nothing, no heart. And it's to be exploited as we wish with our benefit, without any hindrance. So I want to read a paragraph from a book called Animate Earth by Stephen Harding. He's a scientist and eco-philosopher at Schumacher College in England. So he says, many green thinkers agree that this mechanistic worldview has brought us to the brink of a catastrophe so great that our very civilization is threatened, and that we urgently need to make peace with nature by rediscovering and embodying a worldview that reconnects us with a deep sense of participating in a cosmos suffused with intelligence, beauty, intrinsic value, and profound meaning. And in this book, we will ask to what extent it is possible to use recent scientific discoveries about the Earth to develop a deep reverence for our planet home so that we can then engage in actions consistent with this reverence, for science is a dangerous gift unless it can be brought into contact with the wisdom that resides in the sensual, intuitive, and ethical aspects of our natures. You can go to the next slide. So this lists the ecological catastrophe, and I'm not even talking about global warming. There's 1 to 2% of tall grass prairies left, less than 5% of old growth forests that are left. Less than 50% of wetlands are left in the lower 48 states. And we've replaced that with 210 million acres of corn and soybeans and another 40 million acres of lawn. And that's not even counting all the concrete in all the cities. Our waterways are polluted. Our fish are not edible. And our reservoirs are being compromised. We all know about sedimentation in our reservoirs. And people have asthma, they have allergies, depression, high blood pressure, obesity. And there's a lot of people say that their life has no meaning. And with a universe as machine, there is no meaning. But with a more loving, well, with a different worldview, one where, you can go to the next slide, where Gaia is alive, you have meaning. You can get meaning in just listening to the wind or hugging grandmother Oak. It's very, very amazing. I want to read another quote. This is from Stephen Buhner's book, The Lost Language of Plants. He has a really good description of the earth, if I can find it. Okay, here it is. Imagine a ball of twine, the exact size and shape of Earth. Better yet, telephone line. Take the end point of the line and weave it back into the beginning so that there's no beginning and no end. Every place the line crosses itself, you could think of them as synaptic junctions if you want. Messages cross over. Communication travels quickly throughout the entire line itself as well. Academic disciplines are areas where a segment of line is cut out of the ball and studied. They explore its tensile strength, its molecular structure, its chemical composition, the colors and types of wires that run through it. Any communications that were flowing or might flow through it cannot be studied once it is cut out of the hole. Only a tiny part of the picture can be seen. Misunderstandings easily arise, especially if the communications that flow through the line are the most important thing. Turn the ball of telephone line back into Earth. Each plant, plant neighborhood, plant community, ecosystem, biome has messages flowing through it constantly, trillions and trillions of messages at the same time. The messages are complex communications between all the different parts of the ecosystem. There is no beginning, no end, no cause, and no effect. The 3.5 billion-year-old feedback loops of Earth are closely intertwined, that there is always another cause underneath whatever cause you begin with. Impacts at any one point affect every other point in the system. Life is so closely coupled with the physical and chemical environment of which it is a part that the two cannot be legitimately viewed in isolation from one another. As James Lovelock says, together they constitute a single evolutionary process which is self-regulating. So that's Gaia. And our Earth is alive. You can see the data right here. The sun is a lot hotter than it was 3.5 million years ago, but our temperatures stay fairly constant. It's a little different with global warming. The CO2 and temperature cycles in 10,000-year increments, but the CO2 concentrations have stayed between 180 and 300 million parts. Parts per million, but that's until recently. And O2 concentrations stay around 15 to 25%. If they go less than 15%, we can't start a fire. If it goes beyond 25%, then we have instantaneous combustion. We have a fire and we can't put it out. And the Earth has recovered from mass extinctions. So it's pretty remarkable, and that's the scientists speaking to us about Gaia. You can go to the next slide. So I prefer a nature that is alive. It's more life-affirming. It's more interesting. It's supporting. And it's magical. It's full of meaning. In each breath, gust of wind, every time you feel, touch, or smell a plant, and you see a bird flying over, maybe a raven squawking, or a bear walking through the woods, and It's very, very wonderful. So I want to read a quote from Julie McIntyre. She's one of my mentors, and Michael knows her pretty well, too. This sums up what I'm talking about when I... Oh, okay. It sums up what becoming indigenous means. Once, a long time ago, ancient and indigenous cultures knew they lived among and with non-human and invisible beings. They knew they shared the earth together, living side by side, always sacred, alive, intelligent, aware, and caring. The divide between human bodies, human consciousness, and the body and consciousness of earth was non-existent. Plants, trees, stones, and the elements were part of daily relationships for food, medicine, and wisdom. They were revered as having soul and intelligence. It was understood that non-human beings had the capacity to feel and communicate. Living with the awareness of wild intelligence was part of the moral fabric of indigenous cultures. There is, in these modern days, a tear in the fabric that holds human beings together in relationship with the non-human community we share life with on Gaia. We have created a split, a chasm that is growing deeper, taking us further away from our bodies and Earth as holy places. Our relationship with Earth and her inhabitants is not the only relationship that is damaged. Relationships we have with ourselves, each other, also have tears in them. So much of our lives we spend trying to navigate the challenges of becoming a human being. Reclaiming the soul, our inherent, intuitive, instinctual nature opens the door to remembering and reclaiming the body of Earth and our bodies as sacred, alive, aware, and intelligent. Nature is our nature, and that is becoming indigenous. So I see a couple things here. It's interesting. That in our culture of today, or even back in the 70s, there have been movements to connect with nature and become one with nature, or however you want to describe it. And the old earth-based cultures, they didn't have that concept. There was no separation. That's a new concept for us, and it goes back to the scientific revolution. And I also think that our one major disease is our lack of connection with divine intelligence. We have many diseases, but that's one I think is paramount. And Stephen Booner talks about that being the interior wound, our separation from divine intelligence. You know, we can read all sorts of books. We can do a lot of praying, but until we get that connection, we're heartbroken. You know, we have that interior wound. The exterior wound is all the damage to the earth that has happened. That breaks our heart too. And then the interior wound is a little more subtle, or maybe it isn't. So you can go to the next slide. Okay, it stands to reason if Gaia is sentient and intelligent that plants are too. They're my allies. They're my friends for many, many years. They are sentient and they are intelligent. That means that they have a consciousness. They don't just sit there waving in the wind. They are concerned with their welfare. They're concerned about their offspring. They search for meaning. All that good stuff, just like we do. And they are, like I say here, they're our chemists. They're tirelessly assembling the molecules of the world. I've got a few other slides, which I'll go through quickly. But essentially, I'm talking about plants, respond to their world. Since they don't move, they have to, and a bug comes and bites them, they have to respond to that bug. They have what scientists call a bunch of secondary compounds. Many, they're chemists, and they, when a bug bites, they will sense that saliva and respond to it. They'll rearrange their chemistry to stop the herbivory or attract a predator, either through pheromones, attract the predator, or mimic the smell of the predator so the bug will leave. They have phytoestrogens that they will put towards the leaf that maybe some sheep have been chewing on, and when they hit 20% herbivory for a population, they'll emit that phytoestrogen and potentially cause abortion in female sheep. So they're very, very intelligent. They know exactly what they're doing. So one more quote here. This is from Invasive Plant Medicine by Timothy Lee Scott. He talks about plant communication. Plants speak to their environment with the chemicals they release. They communicate to the microorganisms through the plants. Root hairs deep in the soil, to those foraging insects that eat their leaves, and to the scavenging animals that eat their fruit. In addition, the plants and their chemicals convey messages for humans, and they speak eloquently with a multisensorial language that we have long admired. We can see this in the beauty of a flower, smell it in a plant's fragrance, and taste it in a plant's flavor. And we can feel it by the impact of a plant's medicine on our body. And then there's listening. Plants emit chemicals into their environment to attract pollinators, repel pests, nourish the soil, and heal themselves and others. They are known to change their form depending on the growing conditions and alter their chemical signals if they feel stressed or threatened, or if they feel affection or gratitude. And throughout time, many people have intuitively recognized this, observing plant changes in the wild and in their own gardens. So you can go to the next slide. And just keep moving a couple more. Okay, one more. And one more. Okay, so plants are alive, active, and intelligent. And humans and other animals are not the only ones that are intelligent. And it's a zoocentric viewpoint if you don't think so. So you can go to the last slide. Or that one, yeah. Okay, so it's hard to know how to wrap this up, but I wanted to talk about. Yeah, go ahead. Oh, yeah, okay. Well, I don't know if I can even read it. Okay, well, I'll just summarize it. Basically, the heart is more than just a pump. It's our organ of perception. I don't know if you've heard of the website HeartMath. They've researched the heart as an organ of perception. This is where your intuitive powers are. No wonder we have language like heartening and heartwarming and heartbroken and disheartened. It's got to do with our feelings. This is where we feel the world. This is where we sense the world around us. That's where that boy Walt picked up his grandmother and the teachings of the oak. And there's exercises you can do to open up your heart. And I've been practicing them for a number of years, and my wife and Michael would vouch that I'm a different person than I was 5 years ago because of that. So our heart has, our body has an electromagnetic field, and every creature, every stone, every paperclip has an electromagnetic field. It might be hard to believe, and that's, you get close enough to a tree or a plant, and that's, you pick up their EMF electromagnetic field, and they pick up yours. And that's where, when your EMFs commingle, that's one way that you can communicate. And communicating is not necessarily talking. You know, we say, well, I communicated with that plant. It's sometimes it's just a knowing. You just feel it. You understand it. And all this has got to do with this coming to our senses, not being in our rational mind. That's where we are really good. We're in our rational mind. You watch little kids who are just sometimes in a magical realm. They're playing with a plant or a bug, and they're talking to it and just having a great grand old time. They're using their heart. They're feeling that plant, and they're communicating in a way that goes that you can't really spell out in words. And as they grow up, they get that conditioned out of them. Let's say they've had a vision or a dream, or and their parents don't know how to deal with it, so they take them to a psychologist. I have a friend who had dreams, and his parents didn't know how to deal with it, and they took him to a psychiatrist. And he realized then that he wasn't going to tell them anymore what types of dreams he had. So that's what I'm talking about. I'm probably not explaining it that well, but we all have had those experiences. We may not remember what it was like as a child. I certainly don't. But you know, anytime you're walking next to someone and they get in your space, you're feeling their energy. You're feeling that. That's with your heart. Or let's say you're sitting here and someone walks in at the door there, and let's say it's the Dalai Lama. Well, you're gonna feel that type of energy from him. Or let's say you're at a party and you keep thinking, someone's looking at me. Someone's looking at me. Well, you're sensing that person and you're doing it from here. We all have those abilities, and it just takes practice to develop that skill. I'll entertain any questions. You can go to the last slide. And that's my dog Gus. He knows all about heart fields and feeling and loving and being in the moment. So any questions? Yeah.
I really appreciated your idea and connection of a tree as magic and Michael's story about a magic tree. I was a campfire girl counselor up at camp outside of Los Angeles and in the mountains. And one of my favorite things to do was, it was just fortuitous. So one overnight in the woods, we stumbled upon this tree. And all laid around it with the kids, their heads to the trunk, and we just formed this circle and laid and looked up through the branches, and magic happened. The communication between the kids and their revelations, their insights into themselves, and I started calling that a magic tree. And made sure that was an experience for as many of the kids as I could manage. So thank you for that.
Oh, you're welcome. That's a wonderful story. And that's information that is theirs forever. And it's not from a book. You can learn a lot from books, but this is true communication between the universe and them, and real special. Any other questions?
Hi, Anna Franklin. This is not exactly a question. I own a yoga studio in town, which I recently changed the name of to Heart Space Yoga, because it really became clear to me. My original name, which was Yoga Connection, was trying to articulate, but then it really became clear to me. A couple things happened. Well, one thing I was pondering was the way that animals and dogs, looking at your photograph, will just naturally go towards children or towards people that they feel a good feeling, a good mm-hmm. vibration, whatever you want to call it. And also, I had a couple times when I was practicing yoga and actually meditating also intensely, I had experiences where people came behind me, and without turning around, I knew who it was.
Mm-hmm.
I could name the person.
Yeah, that's yeah. all part of it,
so
too.
So that's yeah. a vibrational mm-hmm. communication. Yeah.
yeah.
Diane Barker.
Hey. Hi.
Hi. I just want to thank you so much for bringing such a clear and positive message to us. And I just want to verify that as soon as you start respectfully greeting the people in nature, like this beautiful tree, that we all love that tree. And I know that at various times people send it love. But the more you respectfully greet each element and open your heart to it, they'll start speaking to you. And I think that you're giving us the message of hope, that this is the only way to turn things around, the current troubles that we're facing. So thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. It's really all about love. I've been told a number of times by my teachers that you have to love, like for me, the plants as much as I love my wife, as much as I love my family, treat them like a brother or son. And that's not easy to do when you've been, you know, mowing your lawn for years, you've been spraying invasive plants and all that kind of stuff. So, but that's what it's about. And I think Mother Earth, Gaia, is going to be fine. She's had millions of years of experience dealing with fluctuations in temperatures and CO2s and CO2 and all that. But I think what we need to worry about is how we can help our fellow humans and our pets, and how we deal with the crises that we're being confronted by. So, and I think this work that I'm doing, and Michael has certainly done some too, is really important with this. I'm agreeing with you, Diane. And it's good to see you. I haven't seen you in quite a while.
Just real quick, like she said about, well, my name's Joy DeMoranville, I'm Frank's wife. Just as we give respect to the trees and to the animals, we receive in return. And once I was, I had to have a surgery. I've never had surgery before, and I was really clear that that's what I needed to do. But one day I woke up and I was really fearful about it because it was something really new and scary to me. And so I was driving down my road and there was a blue heron that was standing on the bridge. I've never seen a blue heron standing on the bridge. And as my car was proceeding east down my road, the blue heron started flying right in front of my car. And the wingspan was completely across the front of my windshield. And I just slowed down, and the blue heron sort of led me down the road. And as I was following this heron so closely, it just gave me this feeling that everything was going to be okay. And so after that, I felt fine, and the surgery went well, and everything was good. So I only had one little morning of fear, and the blue heron just told me it was going to be okay. So it goes both ways.
Well, thank you for your speech and... closer? Okay. Is this better? Okay, thanks. Well, I'm really relieved to hear somebody speaking about these things because I'm a student at Kansas State University, and it's been really kind of emotionally stressful for me to go through the classes that I've gone through and ask questions about these things, like the electromagnetic field of the heart, and I've taken a basic crystallography class and several physics classes, and whenever I ask my instructors or my peers about their thoughts on these types of things, they seem kind of scared to talk about it or sort of taken aback by it. And I've had similar experiences in clubs at the university. I was president for a little while of Students for Environmental Action just for 1 year, and I found that whenever I tried to talk to people about our connection with nature or these types of communication that you talk about, they just seem to be very closed off to it. And I don't know if you have any advice that you might be willing to share about how to talk to people about these things, because I think maybe some of us here share the same feeling that I've had. I just really would like to be able to communicate more with the people in my community about these things.
That's a really good question. I think you have to pick and choose. Most scientifically trained people think this is all superstition, or I don't know the other terms, but they just dismiss it, and that's the way it's going to be. You have to be careful who you talk to, just so you don't get hurt, and so that your enthusiasm doesn't get dampened. I'm a scientist. I was trained as a scientist, but I've had that feeling. I've had the desire to connect with nature for a long time, and you just have to be strong and search out people that can help you with your teachings, and pick and choose who you want to talk to. That's all that I can think of right now.
Yeah. Well, I love that Baroque at least as much as anybody else in this room does. And I love it so much that I would like to have about the bottom six branches cut off it so that the tree could devote more of its energy to growing up and out, and so that I could have a long vista to look at. As a prairie billy, trees are fine as long as they're in their place. And that means that they take account of what the rest of us need too. I've never been able to get very far with that effort.
Yeah, I'm not sure what to say to that.
I'm Tom Phillips, and now Michael motivated me to say this. I'm trained as a scientist. I think you'll find many people in the congregation are, and I do biology. And, the more I learn, the more I realize how wonderful the universe is. I mean, we can predict with experience, we can predict how an insect's going to go, and we do an experiment with that hypothesis, and it works, and it's wonderful. But still, it strengthens my feeling that we are just part of the universe. We're not in charge. It's not up to us. But we can observe it and think about it and enjoy it. But, you know... you can extend that then, that it's our will needs to be kept in check, that it's up to some other higher being or some other part of the universe. And as a teacher at K-State, I guess I would feel to be careful about any spiritual comments, but if a student came up afterwards, I'd be happy to talk about it.
Yeah, we're just... a cog in the wheel. We're not, we make ourselves very, very special, and we are special, but we're no more special than the microbes, the plants, the animals, the wind, the rain, all of that. And I try to approach all this practice, this spiritual path with humility, and because I'm no more important than anything else. And it's reassuring when I come to this with humility, as the door is open much easier that way. So thanks, Tom.
I used to have this job working with low-income people for a literacy program, and most of them lived in what the average person would say, like, crummy housing, but actually they lived in trailers or little houses on the outskirts of town. in very beautiful places. And so I had some of the kids I worked with had horrible anger problems. And so I don't know. I guess I do this with myself. I do find nature and trees in particular very calming. So I would do this activity with the kids. And then later we did it. I did it all the many years I worked in Sunday school, had the kids find a special place, usually a tree, and they kept a notebook and documented how they felt about it and looked at it as the seasons changed. And then I would tell them, like, if you're at school and you feel just absolutely horrible and you're going to blow your stack, just think of your secret place. And I don't know, I got a lot out of it. I hope they did. And also I had this unusual experience this past week. I went with some of my friends out on the prairie, and this one couple has a platform, and you can see no lights around you. And we went to stargaze, but my husband and I took our dog, who's kind of a goofball, and he just was sniffing around. But then, as soon as the moon rose, he sat alert and watched the moon come up, and the coyotes were going absolutely crazy. And the next day, at this little store where I work, an Indian man came in, and he told me he now has his 13th dog in his life. And he told me this one's particularly smart. And every day, I didn't bring up this topic. He told me every day he lives on the lake, the dog watches the sun come up for a couple hours and watches the moon rise also. And I thought, wow. And that's another way that I use to calm and center myself is looking at the sky. And I feel my tininess and my problems fall into focus. I mean, I can see them as conquerable when I see how little they are compared to the whole universe.
Thank you, Frank. So with brave... Oh, yes. We'll need these. Turn to 1064 Blue Boat Home. Stand as you're able. And my invitation is to sing with brave humility.
There's a kind of long introduction. Mom, Mary, and I will, and then a bit of a break between each verse. The tune is, I think, familiar, but we'll try to get you into it and to prove.
Casting the question to the deep. are a part of the interconnected web of existence. Feel each fiber, celebrate its connection to all that is, and live in joy and harmony and peace.